I heard the pock, pock, pock of the anti-aircraft guns. My troop would already be at their stations.
They may already be choosing a replacement, I said. I have to get to my AA gun.
Go, Simon told me. Go, I'll be fine. Just do whatever it takes to get yourself on that team.
The Man from Nantucket. I spent the entire air raid reciting English limericks. There once was a farmer from Leeds who swallowed a packet of seeds, I sang as I hauled ammunition to the AA gun. It soon came to pass he was covered with grass, but has all the tomatoes he needs. The other boys stared at me as though I was insane. My jokes were bombing more than the airplanes overhead. I had to admit they might have gone over better if any of them understood English. I carried on undaunted. There once was a man from Nantucket who kept all his cash in a bucket. But his daughter named Nan ran away with a man and asked for the bucket, Nantucket. I laughed at my own joke, which got me more stares.
Wait, here's another, I said, handing off another round for the 88.
A funny old bird is the pelican. His beak can hold more than his belly can. He can take in his beak enough food for a week, but I don't know how the hell he can.
Fritz pulled me aside.
What are you doing?
He asked me in German. What I was doing was trying to remind SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer that I was fluent in English, in case he had forgotten. The SS man was there overseeing our AA gun, but I couldn't explain that to Fritz. I just went back to work. Dozens more limericks and Englishmen, Scotsmen, and Irishmen jokes later, the air raid was over. We had survived round two with the Allied bombers. I had just started to sing Danny Boy for everybody when SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer had us line up for our orders.
Sir, yes, sir, I said in English, and I gave my most enthusiastic salute. Heil Hitler!
Trumbauer nodded at me. Fritz looked at me strangely.
It's time to march, Trumbauer said. We will only go to the bridge and back, so we are not too far away, should there be another air raid.
Sir, Fritz said, am I excused to work on our special SRD training?
Special assassination training, he meant. I knew that now.
Yes, of course, Quex, SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer said. And we need to select a replacement for Max after he died for Germany, don't we?
I licked my lips. Here we go, I thought. My chance to join the science team.
Train well, Fritz, I said in English.
I pretended to catch myself and smacked my forehead.
I'm sorry, I said in German. Sometimes I forget and just say things in English. It is my first language, after all.
Fritz gave me another confused look. I admit I was being pretty obvious about it, but I didn't want Trumbauer to pass me over. Trumbauer walked down the line toward me. I stood tall, stuck out my chest, and the SS man walked right past me.
Horst Furtner, step forward, SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer said. You have been selected for an elite SRD mission.
Horst? Horst? The donkey-faced ogre from our Jungvolk group? How in the world could he be selected for the science team over me? He didn't know a word of English, and he was proud of it. Horst jumped out of the line and threw his arm into the air in a fervent Nazi salute.
Thank you, SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer. I would die for the Fatherland.
I know you would, Horst,
Trumbauer said with an appreciative nod.
Please join Fritz. He will show you the training ground.
Heil Hitler,
Horst yelled, and Trumbauer returned the salute.
Are you sure you don't want me instead?
I blurted out in German. Fritz turned with a frown, as if I was being a fool to speak out when I wasn't supposed to. I probably was, but I needed to join that team.
I am quite confident in the choice I have made, Mr. O'Shaughnessy,
SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer said icily. Fritz gave me a quick shake of the head and turned back to Trumbauer, waiting to be dismissed. I cursed inwardly. How was I going to get on that science team?
Just be sure that the two of you are back this afternoon, SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer told them. We have been invited to a very special event.
Whatever it was so special he swelled with joy. Trumbauer was practically glowing. I wondered if the Nazis had finally gotten so desperate that they were going to give us tanks and turn us loose on the Allies. But no, it was worse. Much, much worse.
This afternoon, SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer told us, this afternoon, we have the great and glorious honor of hearing the Führer speak to us in person.
Evil Leprechaun. We stood in a street outside the old Reich Chancellery. Adolf Hitler ruled the German nation from this building, just as the President of the Weimar Republic had before him, and the Emperor of Prussia before him. The main building was all white columns and tall windows and black gabled roof, like the country house of a European king. Connected to it were modern buildings added by the Nazis, square gray towers with flat roofs, which housed the administrative clerks and officials that formed the octopus-like arms of the government. The Nazis loved their Amtsschimmel, their bureaucratic mildew. The stacks and stacks of government paperwork they used to document every little thing. In English, we called it red tape. If the Allies managed to hit the Reich Chancellery with a bomb, it wouldn't rain brick and ash. It would rain burning papers. But the Chancellery still looked immaculate. I didn't know how they did it. It was brilliant white in a city filled with dust and gray smoke, and covered in crisp, clean red, white, and black swastika flags. But the more I stared at the building, the more I realized there was something off. Most of the flags hung from the usual places, beneath awnings and under windows and over arched walkways. But some of the flags hung in odd places, like between windows and on the roof. One of the oddly placed flags fluttered in the wind, and I saw behind it the wall was cracked and crumbling. The Reich Chancellery had taken damage from Allied bombs after all. The Nazis had just draped swastikas over the damage, hiding it the same way they covered up their recent defeats in Stalingrad and Northern Africa. SS officers surrounded us, members of Hitler's personal guard. The boys around me grew tense, straighter, stood taller. Even I caught myself straining to see around the guards. To see Hitler in person, the great boogeyman that had bedeviled Europe and the rest of the world, was like catching a glimpse of a leprechaun, a very, very evil leprechaun. But it wasn't Hitler who pushed through the guards. It was Arthur Oxmann, the head of the Hitler Youth. You could almost feel a silent collective groan from the boys. None of us had met Oxmann, but none of us particularly wanted to. He was the one who wrote all the ridiculous speeches and silly directives that our youth leaders read to us during our weekly Hitler Youth meetings. Oxmann looked as dumb as his weekly pronouncements, like a thug in an officer's uniform.
"Welcome, welcome," Oxmann said quickly. "This is a great day for you, a great day indeed. To meet me and meet the Führer. I hope you all appreciate what an honor this is. You will tell your grandchildren of this day. I may be your inspiration, your mentor, your second father, but the superimposing leader of all desires of youth is Adolf Hitler."
I fought a powerful urge to roll my eyes. And then, the Führer himself was there. Adolf Hitler. Hitler. Adolf Hitler was a few inches shorter than all of his guards. The first thing you noticed about him was his pale face and his long rat-like nose with that bushy little mustache under it. His dark brown hair swept down across his forehead to just above his eyes, which were baggy and tired-looking. Maybe it was from the long hours spent running a world war. Or maybe he couldn't sleep for all the bombs the Allies dropped on him day and night. He wore the brown uniform and red swastika armband of the German army. But unlike everybody else in Germany who were so mad for medals that they bought them from shops, Hitler wore only one, the Iron Cross First Class he'd won for bravery in World War I. I knew because I'd had to memorize that fact to pass my Hitler Youth initiation. Hitler blinked in the bright sunlight of the late winter afternoon like a hedgehog emerging from hibernation.
"Heil Hitler!" Oxman cried.
We all overcame our momentary astonishment at seeing the Führer in person and threw our right arms in the air.
"Heil Hitler!"
we cried. I felt like a traitor, but this was no time to take a stand. I had to pretend to love him the same way everybody else did. Hitler smiled at us like an affectionate old grandfather.
"Your name, my Führer, is the happiness of youth," Oxman said. "Your name, my Führer, is for us everlasting life."
He was laying it on a bit thick, I thought, but Hitler must have been used to it from everybody he met. He nodded to Oxman, which somehow also seemed to communicate that it was time for him to shut up. Oxman took the hint and faded back among the towering elite SS guards. Hitler looked out over us. Now each and every one of us really was standing as straight and tall as we could get, even me. I needed to blend in, it was true, but there was something about the man that made you want to appear perfect in his eyes. Maybe it was fear.
"The older ones are used up," Hitler said.
He spoke so softly at first that we had to lean in to hear him, which was a good trick, I realized.
"We are rotten to the marrow. We are cowardly and sentimental."
"No,"
some of the boys called out. Hitler held up a hand to quiet them.
"It is true. We adults bear the burden, have a humiliating past, and have in our blood the dull recollection of serfdom and servility. But, my magnificent youngsters," Hitler said, gazing out lovingly at all of us, "are there any finer ones in the world? Look at these young men and boys. What material. With you, I can make a new world. This is the heroic stage of youth. Out of it will come the creative man, the man-god. You."
A tingle thrilled through me, despite how much I hated him. To hear someone tell you that you will rebuild the world, that you will be a hero, a man-god, was a powerful thing. I wanted to do all that, to be all that, just not for Hitler and the Nazis.
"You, my youth, are our nation's most precious guarantee for a great future."
Hitler's voice rose as he went on.
"The thousand-year Reich. You are destined to be the leaders of a glorious new order under the supremacy of National Socialism. Never forget that one day you will rule the world."
The boys around me broke out in a spontaneous "Sieg Heil!"
"Learn, while you are still young, that life for you must mean sacrifice. Sacrifice of your personal freedom. Sacrifice of your free time. Sacrifice of many of the small pleasures of life."
I turned to look at Fritz, who stood beside me. He wasn't looking at Hitler just then. He had his eyes to the ground just beyond the Führer, as though something Hitler said had him lost in thought.
"To do so, you must be violently active, dominating, intrepid, brutal."
Hitler's voice rose and fell, ebbing and flowing like the Irish Sea. It was captivating, impossible to ignore.
"Youths must be indifferent to pain. There must be no weakness in you, no tenderness. You must learn to do without, to endure criticism and injustice, to be reliable, discreet, decent, and loyal. You must be as swift as greyhounds, tough as leather, as hard as crop steel.
I noticed Hitler didn't say anything about being smart. Intelligence had no place in the Hitler Youth, or in Nazi Germany, for that matter. But Fritz was nodding emphatically beside me. Whatever it was he'd been thinking about, he'd made up his mind. Hitler started in on how the tide of the war would soon turn in Germany's favor again, and I tuned out. From the corner of my eye, I watched Fritz and Horst and Ottmar and Erhard, the four boys on the science team. They quivered as Hitler spoke, like five-year-olds so anxious to open their presents on Christmas morning they were going to puke. They were euphoric, ecstatic. They could barely control themselves. Tears filled their eyes. Not everyone was like that, I realized. Everyone was a little awestruck, but those four looked like they were about to drop to their knees and kiss the ground Hitler walked on. Every time he talked about tossing Germany's enemies back into the sea or smashing the Russians, they were the first and the loudest to shout, "Heil Hitler!" And that's when I finally understood. That's when I knew why Fritz and Horst and Ottmar and Erhard were on the science team, and why I wasn't. Super Nazis.
"They're fanatics," I told Simon.
After getting home from the Hitler rally, I'd burst into my house and run straight to the secret room.
"That's why they were recruited, because they're zealots. You should have seen these four guys. It was like God himself had come down from on high to talk to them. I saw it in their faces, heard it in their shouts. It's like a religion for them. They believe Hitler's nonsense, Aryan supremacy, the Jewish threat, world domination, all of it."
"So speaking English has nothing to do with it," Simon said.
"No, they love Hitler so much they would do anything for him, kill for him, die for him. To get on that team, all I have to do is prove to them I'm a super Nazi. I just don't know how."
Simon nodded.
"I know how," he said. "You have to turn me in."
No joke. "You have to turn me in." Simon's words hung in the air like a bomb waiting to explode.
"No," I said. "Never."
My parents joined us in the secret room, and Simon told them his idea.
"I won't do it," I said. "I can't. It would ruin everything. What about Project 1065? If Simon's caught, the Allies will never get the jet fighter plans."
"You'll have to take those with you to Switzerland," Simon said. "You can give them to Professor Goldschmidt to take back to the Allies after you stop his assassination."
I threw my hands up, because that wouldn't be dangerous at all. If I got caught with the plans for Project 1065, I wouldn't even make it to Switzerland to save Goldschmidt. But that wasn't nearly the biggest problem with this plan.
"You'll get in trouble too," I told my parents. "They'll know you hit him here."
Da nodded. Ma sat down slowly in Da's desk chair. They were on the fence, I could tell. But the fact that they were even considering this was crazy. I stood and went to my parents.
"We can't do this," I said to Ma. "You told me before, it's too valuable to give up everything you've worked for just for one man, and Goldschmidt's just one man." "One man who may know how to build an atomic bomb," Ma said. "Not to mention that this could finally get those jet fighter plans into the hands of the Allies. We just have to decide if it's worth trading one for the other."
"The decision is whether or not we can put our son in that kind of danger," Da said.
"He can do it.
I know he can," Simon said.
It's what I'd wanted to hear, what I'd longed to hear, that I was good enough to be a proper spy. But now I didn't want it, not if it meant giving up Simon to the Nazis.
"Michael, you have to save Professor Goldschmidt," Simon said. "The only way you can do it is to get on that team. And the only way you can get on that team is to do something so radical they automatically promote you. Like the boy who turned in his parents. And you'll be doing him one better. you'll be turning in a British spy who also just happens to be a Jew.
I shook my head. I felt sick, like I might throw up or cry. I'd had fun sneaking around and writing coded messages. Memorizing the plans for Project 1065 had been fun, too. Up until now, it had all been a game. Kim's game, the game of spies. But if I turned Simon in, if I turned my parents in, this wouldn't be a game anymore. This would be real. We were talking about real sacrifice here, and not my sacrifice, the sacrifice of people I loved and cared about.
You'll be sent to a concentration camp, I told my parents, my voice cracking.
No, Da said. We'll be long gone.
I frowned. What was he talking about?
I want out, Michael, Da said. I want all of us out. It's too dangerous. The tide is turned with the German defeat at Stalingrad. The Nazis are like cornered animals, savage, wild. Putting 13-year-olds in charge of anti-aircraft guns. Sending 17-year-olds to the front lines. I don't know how much longer the war will last. Another year? Two? Three? But the longer it lasts, the more abominable the Nazis will become. One way or another, we will die if we stay here. I've already talked it over with your mother.
Ma nodded, her lips pursed.
We were going to put in for a transfer, she explained. But if we turn Simon in to get Michael on the team, there won't be time for that. We'll have to sneak out. I'll get in touch with my network. By the time Simon is taken into protective custody, your father and I will have disappeared. It'll make us look more to guilty anyhow, and you more to hero.
But you said it would take weeks to set up another escape route for Simon, I said, desperately trying to find a logical reason to cancel this crazy plan.
And now you're going to escape?
Yes, Ma said.
We'll be winging it, to be sure. But I know the network, and the both of us know the territory.
Da nodded at her.
Simon didn't, and we have diplomatic immunity, which might count for something if we're caught.
It's the Nazis! Diplomatic immunity won't count for anything, and you know it! If you're caught, you'll be killed!
I was on the verge of tears again.
We'll be killed if we stay, Da said.
I paced restlessly. And Simon? I asked.
Simon bowed his head. No one else answered the question, so I did for them.
He'll be sent to a concentration camp, I said.
I saw it all in my head cinema. Torture, interrogation, imprisonment, all the horrible things everybody knew happened at the concentration camps, but we didn't let ourselves think about. Da signaled for me to sit and be quiet, and Ma went to the door to make sure none of the staff were listening in. I sat back down in my chair, my chest heaving. My hands balled into fists. I desperately wanted to hit something.
Did you hear the one about the Englishman, the Irishman, and the Scotsman who were all sentenced to a year in prison? Simon asked.
I don't want to hear any jokes, I told him.
He was trying to calm me down, but I didn't want to be calm.
I'm not turning you in, Simon. It's not worth it.
Simon got serious.
Michael, the atomic bomb program is perhaps the most important project of the entire war, maybe of all time. If this thing does what people think it will change the way wars are fought. It will change the whole world, far more than any jet fighter plans. Every night, the British dropped tens of thousands of bombs on Berlin, and it still stands. With an atomic bomb, you drop just one, and it destroys an entire city. If there can be such a thing as an atomic bomb, it's vital the Allies build one first. And Professor Goldsmith is vital to its creation.
Da took a deep breath and nodded.
Then we do it.
Ma took my hand and nodded her agreement.
I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I pulled my hand away and stood, but I didn't yell.
No, I can't. I won't. There has to be another way, I told them.
And I left to go find it. A walking A-bomb. People stepped off the sidewalk to avoid me as I walked through the streets of Berlin.
I liked to think it was the angry aura around me, the clenched fists that told them not to bump into me, or there'd be a fight. That I was a walking atomic bomb, ready to go off and level this stinking city any second. The truth was, of course, it was the uniform that made them scared. But I pretended they could feel the rage coming off of me in waves, like I could warp the world with my fury. I wished I could. Turn in Simon. Send my parents on the run. How could they really think that was the answer? How did they really think I could do that? I had to find another way to get on that team. My feet took me to Fritz's house before I even understood my idea. It wasn't a particularly good idea, but it was all I could think of, all that made it through the white noise of outrage screaming in my head like an air raid siren. Fritz was the answer. He had to be. He and I were friends, of a sort. We had been friends once, briefly. True, over the last couple of weeks we'd grown apart, and not just because he'd been spending most of his free time with the science team. It was more than that. Fritz was changing, becoming something different, something I didn't like. But that boy who'd asked me to help him be stronger, that boy who'd helped me be stronger, the boy who dragged me upstairs to share his detective novels with me, that boy, that friend, had to still be in there somewhere. And that friend would see the light. That friend would help me save the scientist. Fritz's sister, Lena, met me at the door. "Hello, future wife," I said. "Is my future brother-in-law home?" Lena didn't say a word, but opened the door wider for me to come inside. She pointed not upstairs where Fritz's room was, but down the first floor hallway to the back of the house. I went down the hall to the kitchen at the back of the house, but Fritz wasn't there. I sniffed. I thought I smelled smoke, but the oven wasn't on and there was nothing on the stove. I caught a glimpse of a dark gray cloud curling into the sky through the window in the back door, and I stepped outside. Fritz was in the backyard, throwing his collection of detective novels into a bucket full of flames. Boy Men. I threw myself across the yard, grabbing the book in Fritz's hand. "What are you doing?" I cried. "Stop!" Half his collection was already burning in the bucket. Fritz yanked the book back from me and tried to hold it over his head where I couldn't reach it, but I was taller than he was. I snatched at the book, and we wrestled over it for a few desperate seconds until at last I had it. I was about to ask him again what the bloody hell he thought he was doing when he punched me in the nose. It was fast and straight, and his feet were planted just right, and I'd never seen it coming. All the things I'd taught him to do. I staggered back, lost my footing, and fell on my butt. I put a hand to my nose and came away with blood. Fritz stood over me, a look of fierce cruelty in his knitted eyebrows, and suddenly I understood why Fritz had wanted me to teach him how to fight, why he'd been so desperate to join the SRD. All his life, Fritz had been the boy with the bloody nose sitting here on the ground, looking up at the bully who'd beaten him. He'd joined the SRD so he could become the bully himself, just like little Hitler. "So this is what it's come to," I said. I didn't get up. I didn't want to fight Fritz. That's not why I was here. "You'd burn these books," I said. I hurled the book I'd taken back at him, and he batted it away. "You'd burn something you love just to be on top for once in your life, even if it means turning your back on who you are." Fritz tugged at his SRD uniform. "This is who I am. I'm going to lead Germany into the future. I'm going to help Hitler rule the world. But to do that, I have to make sacrifices," he said, quoting the Führer back to me. "You've burned books, too. You made me burn books that day the other boys attacked me. I told you to burn those books so the other boys wouldn't kill you." "No," Fritz said. He picked up the book I'd thrown at him. "They were right. This is degenerate filth. I should never have read it to begin with. And neither should you. A good Nazi doesn't need books or philosophy or art. We think
with our blood. You sink with your blood? I said. What does that even mean? How is that even possible?
Fritz threw the book back at me, but I ducked it.
You've never taken any of this seriously, Michael. You've always treated this like a game. Maybe it's because you're not German, but this isn't a game. It's real.
It was strange hearing the things I'd just been saying to myself come from Fritz's lips. It was as though I suddenly stepped outside myself and saw me sitting there on the ground at Fritz's feet. We were just 13, me and Fritz, but we didn't look like boys anymore. Nazi Germany, the war, the Hitler Youth, all of it had made us into men. Not man-gods, as Hitler had said, but boy-men. Boys whose insides, whose hearts and minds and souls had been forced to grow up faster than our bodies. The war had made us men, and it was time to act like it.
My parents are spies, I said.
All in. I felt lightheaded as I said it, hollow, like it was some dream version of me, something that would go away when I woke up. Fritz froze.
What?
I wet my dry lips.
You're right. It's time for me to stop playing games, to commit myself completely. It's time I told the truth. My parents are spies. They're harboring the British airman, the one we were searching for in the countryside. They're hiding him until they can get him out of the country.
Fritz staggered back, the black smoke from the burning book swirling around him.
Where? I don't know, I lied. But they're moving him tonight. You have to tell the Gestapo. I'll find out where and when and lead them there.
Fritz blinked in amazement. His eyes went elsewhere as he considered all this, then finally found my face. When they did, the anger was gone, replaced by something like admiration, awe. He offered me his hand to help me up, and I took it. We were friends again, and I was the boy who denounced his parents to the Nazis. There was only one thing left to do. How to Take a Beating, Part 2. I caught Horst later that day coming home from the overage movie he'd snuck in to see at the cinema. I knew I could beat Horst in a fair fight, but this wasn't going to be a fair fight. I hurried up behind him, threw a flour sack over his head, and kicked him in the back of the knee. He went down hard on the sidewalk, and before he could tear the sack off his head and see who attacked him, I kicked him hard, right in the ribs. I heard something crack, and he screamed and doubled over. A quick German look told me we were still alone, and I kicked him again and again. His arms, his legs, his chest, his head. He'd had this coming ever since he'd been our Jungvolk leader, ever since he'd let the bigger boys pound the smaller boys for fun, ever since he'd put me and Fritz in the ring together and told him to keep getting up, ever since he'd beaten that Edelweiss pirate to within an inch of his life. I gave Horst the beatdown he'd delivered to so many other boys, the beatdown I wanted the Allies to give to that bully Adolf Hitler. I kicked him and kicked him and kicked him until he didn't scream anymore, didn't moan, didn't move. He was still alive when I finished, but just barely. I dipped two fingers in the blood that was pooling on the sidewalk underneath him, and on the wall above his broken body, I drew a picture of an Edelweiss. Tonight. I led my parents into Da's study when I got home and pulled Simon out of the hidden room. We have to do it tonight, I told them. This time, my voice didn't crack. There's been an opening on the science team. Owls in the Night. It was colder that night, as if winter had given spring a thrashing that would lay it up in the hospital for another month. I stamped my feet and buried my hands in the heavy overcoat I wore. It was even colder by the River Spree, on the pedestrian path underneath the Moltke Bridge. There were no Fußgängers down here tonight, No footgoers, not officially. It was after curfew. Everyone but the SRD and the Gestapo were supposed to be shut up tight in their homes. A dozen of us waited in the shadows, owls in the night waiting for our prey to emerge. Our steamy breaths made faint gray clouds in the darkness.
"There's Horst," I whispered to Fritz.
Otmar and Erhard had been there when we set out from the Gestapo station, but not the fourth musketeer.
"The pirates got him," Fritz growled.
I nodded. Not that Fritz or anyone else could see me, which let me smile a little in the darkness. The smile quickly faded, though. I was far too nervous about what was about to happen to enjoy my easy victory over donkey-faced Horst. We heard a soft step on the cement path under the bridge, and the breathing around me stopped as we all strained our ears to listen. A whisper, words I couldn't understand. The sound of scuffling feet. Whoever it was, they were coming our way. The wait was agonizing. My stomach did somersaults.
Was this Simon?
Or had we unwittingly scheduled this little piece of theater in the same place and on the same night that some family was trying to escape? Some Edelweiss pirates were attempting an act of vandalism. And if it was Simon, would the SS shoot first and ask questions later? Would he be sent to a concentration camp? What if the nervous sweat rolling down my back made the tape around my waist come loose and the blueprints for Project 1065 slipped out of my shirt? What if the Nazis still didn't pick me for the team after I'd turned Simon and my parents in? A flashlight clicked on, catching Simon full in the face. He looked genuinely startled. He flinched as if to run, but another flashlight clicked on, and another, and Simon blinked and raised his hands against the light that held him in place. It was obvious there were too many of us for him to run away. Simon was caught. Knowing what's to come.
"Where are your parents?"
SS Obersturmfuhrer Trumbauer asked me.
I don't know. They were supposed to be with him," I said, giving the answer my mother and father had prepared for me.
"The embassy, go, go,"
Trumbauer said, dispatching some of his soldiers.
"Find them."
I held my breath as the soldiers ran off into the night. I prayed my parents wouldn't be caught. They should already have been gone from the city hours ago, but it was a long way from Berlin to Dublin, and they would have very few allies along the way. SS Obersturmfuhrer Trumbauer walked up close to Simon, who was being held by two SS men. Simon wasn't squirming or trying to get away.
"You should know, it was the O'Shaughnessy's son who turned you in. Turned his parents in, too," Trumbauer said, with unmitigated delight.
It wasn't enough that he'd caught Simon. He wanted to rub my betrayal in his face.
"Michael?" Simon said, searching the darkness. "Michael, say it isn't so."
The heartbreak in his voice was so real I thought my own heart would explode. How could anybody do this to someone else? But I had a part to play, or else this would all be for nothing. I pushed through the other SRD boys in the darkness and stepped into the light.
"You're an enemy of the state,"
I told Simon, my voice shaky.
"And my parents broke the laws of Germany hiding you. But even worse, they broke the laws of human nature. They betrayed the Aryan race by hiding a Jew."
I said the word like an insult, like profanity.
"How can you say that?" Simon asked. "How can you believe any of it?"
I stood taller, making sure the flashlights caught my puffed-up chest, my upturned chin.
"Because I belong to Hitler now."
"I can see that you do," Simon said. "Well, if you belong to Hitler, why don't you go to him? Go to the devil!"
One of the soldiers slammed the stock of his rifle into Simon's stomach, and Simon doubled over in pain. I had to resist crying out for the soldier to stop and did my best to hold back my tears. The boy in me was scared for what was going to happen to Simon now, scared to be on my own for the very first time in my life. I took a deep breath and tried to remember to be a man.
"I wonder, Michael," Simon said, still hunched over in pain. Did you ever hear the one about the Englishman, the Irishman, and the Scotsman who were all lined up in front of a firing squad?
I couldn't believe Simon was telling jokes here, now. I didn't even have a chance to stammer a response before he went on.
The lads are told they each can have a final request. The Scotsman says, I'd like to hear Scotland the Brave played on the bagpipes before I'm shot, to remind me of the old country. And the Irishman says, I'd like to hear Danny Boy sung by Gracie Fields before I'm shot, to remind me of the old country. So, knowing what's to come, the Englishman says, I'd like to be shot first.
Simon yanked himself free, decked the closest SS man, and sprinted down the tunnel. Whistles blew, people shouted, shots rang out. Simon fell. No! Without thinking, I ran to him, but luckily others did, too. One of the SS was already kneeling down beside him when I got there.
He's dead, he said.
Anything and everything.
He died while trying to escape.
There was almost happiness in SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer's voice as he said it. One more dead Jew, and an enemy soldier to boot. No sucker punch, no broken bone had ever hurt so much as this. My knees went weak, like I was up on the rooftop with Simon all over again, the bombs exploding all around us. It was all I could do to stay on my feet, to not double over and sob like a baby. I couldn't keep the tears from streaming down my face, though, and I turned away so no one would see. Simon had meant to do this all along, I realized. As soon as he'd suggested I turn him in, he'd planned to get shot, to die trying to escape rather than be taken alive by the Nazis. He knew what was to come, even if he pretended it didn't matter. If they took him alive, they would torture him, and eventually he'd tell them about stealing the plans for Project 1065. Maybe even tell them about me and how I had helped him. He died to protect me, to protect his mission. Committed suicide by Nazi. Now they couldn't torture Simon Cohen, and he couldn't reveal any secrets, because Simon Cohen was dead.
Why do you cry?
SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer asked, shining his light in my face. I hurriedly wiped away my tears.
I can't believe my parents threw their lives away for this filth, I said, thinking fast. I can't believe they didn't see that he who serves the Führer serves Germany, and whoever serves Germany serves God.
It was Nazi claptrap propaganda, but SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer nodded with approval. He put a comforting hand on my shoulder. It was all I could do not to flinch away from it.
You have done well, Michael, SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer told me. Very well. You have done more for Hitler tonight than most men twice your age.
He called Fritz and Otmar and Erhard over with a flick of his head, and I tried not to watch as Simon's body was dragged away by the others.
In fact, SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer said, I am in charge of training a select group of young men such as yourself for a very special mission for the Führer, and we have an open position as a team.
He nodded at Fritz.
Krex here has suggested you for the job, and I quite agree with his recommendation.
Fritz smiled. I would have too if I hadn't just watched Simon gunned down in cold blood. I thought of my parents somewhere out there in the cold, dark night on the run from the Nazis. At least it all hadn't been for nothing.
I would give anything and everything to be on that team, I told SS Obersturmführer Trumbauer.
And I already had. 8,422 feet. The cable car bumped and juddered as it went over one of the pylons that supported it during its 4,000-foot climb. I closed my eyes and gripped the metal bench so hard it left deep lines in my skin. I felt lightheaded, and not just because of the thin air of the Swiss Alps. Standing at the base of the aerial tramway in Mürren, I had watched the tiny little cable cars as they moved up and down the mountain, hanging from spiderweb-thin cables that snaked up into the snow-capped peaks above us. Now I was inside one of those little trams, dangling 100 feet over a sea of green fir trees and white snow. Not that I was looking out the window.
"I think I can see my house from here," Otmar said.
He and Erhard both ran back and forth across the cabin, weaving between the other passengers for the best views. I wished they would just sit still. Every time they moved from one side to the other, I could feel the cabin sway left to right, right to left.
"Is your friend going to be all right?"
a woman asked Fritz, who sat beside me.
"He looks a little green."
"Something he ate," Fritz said.
All this time, and he was still covering for me, still helping me hide the fact that I was deathly afraid of heights. I was better with heights now than I ever had been, able to actually step onto a cable car I knew was about to climb up the second half of an 8,422-foot-tall mountain, for example, but only because of the work I'd done with Simon. Simon. Whenever I closed my eyes, all I could see was him looking up at me, punching an SS officer, running, twisting as the bullets hit him, falling. I saw it play out in my head over and over again like a piece of broken film. Why did you have to do it, Simon? Surely there had to have been some other way. I wrenched my eyes open. The brilliant blue of the alpine sky glared back at me through the windows. So many windows, and I quickly stared at the floor. I had to ignore what I knew lay just outside the walls and floor of the cabin. Space, empty air, nothing. An Irishman, a Scotsman, and an Englishman apply for a chauffeur's job, I thought, trying to distract myself, remembering Simon. I'm such a good driver. I can go within 6 inches of a cliff and not drive off, says the Scotsman. I'm such a good driver, I can go within 1 inch of a cliff and not drive off, says the Englishman. Oh yeah, says the Irishman. Well, I'm such a good driver, I stay as far away from cliffs as I can. The long arm atop the cable car rumbled across another pylon, and I put a hand to my mouth for fear I'd puke all over the lady standing in front of us.
Zatvich doesn't destroy us, makes us stronger, Fritz said,
quoting an old German philosopher the Nazis loved. The last thing I needed right now was Nazi platitudes, but I nodded. I had to keep playing the part of the zealous Hitler youth, for a little while longer anyway.
There it is, someone said at last. The resort!
The Waiting Snake. The Edelweiss Resort clung to the side of a mountain a few 100 feet below the peak, its spindly-looking wooden pillars supporting decks that stuck out into the air. It was all golden-brown wood and soft glowing lights and pointy A-frame roofs covered with windows and terraces that offered guests incredible sweeping long-distance views of the valley far below. Basically, it was an acrophobe's worst nightmare. My legs wobbled as I left the cable car, but I was glad to be back on solid ground, even if that solid ground was 8,000 feet in the air. I kept my back to the view and my eyes on the resort, where all the passengers were queuing up in a Warteschlange, a waiting snake, German for a long line, to go through security. Security. The Swiss soldiers at the doors were going through the bags of each of the attendees and patting each of them down. For weapons, I guessed, though one man in the full dress uniform of a country I didn't recognize was let through with the sword on his belt. They were searching for guns then. Guns and explosives. I glanced at Fritz and the other two boys. Each of us carried two cases, one with our clothes and another with the scientific equipment to assemble our fake science projects. To attend the conference, we were posing as junior scientists, and the kits were our cover. I had no idea what the plan was, how we were supposed to assassinate Professor Goldschmidt. Only Otmar knew the plan, which he promised he would tell us when we got to the resort. Did he carry a rifle in his second suitcase? A bomb? If the Swiss guards at the door discovered the weapon we were to use to kill Professor Goldschmidt, if they caught us and sent us back to Germany with our tails between our legs, then my job would be done for me. My parents, Simon, they would have sacrificed themselves for nothing. But the professor would be safe, and that's what mattered now. What I was worried about were the plans for Project 1065 taped around my stomach. One simple pat to the side of my body, and the guards would feel the tape there, open my shirt, reveal the jet fighter plans I was still carrying. They might not care that I was hiding papers on my body, but Otmar and Erhardt and Fritz would care. I would never leave this resort with the plans, if I left the resort alive at all. The waiting snake slithered closer to the Swiss guards at the door, and the plans felt like a stone hanging around my waist. I had to get rid of the papers before we went through security, put them somewhere safe where I could retrieve them on the way out. A low stone wall separated the aerial tramway station from the small plaza where we waited. That cable car was the only way out of the resort, the only way down the mountain. "I'll be right back," I told Fritz, Otmar, and Erhardt. I broke away from the line and went behind the low wall. I felt along it for a loose stone and finally found one about the right size. I would hide the plans here, in the stone wall, where they would be safe from snow and Nazi assassins and Swiss guards, then come back for them on the way to the cable car when I was leaving. I had to duck not to be seen over the low wall. I unbuttoned my shirt enough to reach inside and undid the medical tape Ma had given me to strap the plans to my skin. At last, they were free, and I pulled out the thick packet of papers.
"What are you doing?" a voice asked.
A thorough security check. I was so surprised, I nearly jumped off the mountain. It was Fritz. He was staring down at me from the other side of the wall. I hastily stuffed the jet plans back inside my shirt and kept my hand there, bent double to hide them. Had Fritz seen me pull them out?
I still feel sick from the cable car ride, I told Fritz,
which was truer than I wanted to admit.
I came back here in case I needed to throw up, so the others wouldn't see. Will you cover for me?
Of course, Fritz said.
Take whatever time you need.
Fritz disappeared, and I let out the breath I'd been holding. My heart was still racing from the scare, and my fingers fumbled the packet as I withdrew it again. I pulled the stone from the wall, worked the plans as far inside the hole as I could, and wedged the stone back into place. It stuck a few inches out from the wall, making it pretty easy to find again. I came back to Fritz, Otmar, and Erhardt just as they reached the Swiss guards at the door. The Swiss wore gray uniforms with red collars signifying their rank, but where other countries would use stars, the little pips were shaped like Edelweiss.
"You're fine to go through,"
the Swiss guard at the door said, waving us inside without checking our bags or patting us down. I couldn't believe it. They were just going to let us through? Because we were children? It was just like Ma had told me. Women and children make terrific spies because people always underestimate us. So this was why the Nazis sent boys to do the work of men. Did no one else have any idea what monsters the Hitler Youth were? What we were capable of? What we had been training to do since we were 10? They didn't even take our daggers from us.
"Wait, you're not going to..."
I started to say, but Otmar pulled me through the door with the rest of them and we were inside. Fritz murmured something to Otmar, who nodded and sent Fritz on some assignment. I looked around for another Swiss soldier. They were all over the resort. I had to get word to one of them, let them know what was happening. Then they could search our bags and see why the team had been sent. I headed for a blonde guard in the lobby. Otmar grabbed my shirt and pulled me back.
No wandering, he said. Let's get to our room. It's time to set up our experiment.
The science experiment. Otmar emptied the contents of his suitcase out on one of the beds in our room. I scanned the equipment, looking for a gun, a bomb, anything, but it was only a random collection of scientific equipment, just like mine. I frowned.
Empty the others, Otmar told us.
Erhard and I overturned the scientific suitcases onto the bed. It was a kuddelmoodle. There was nothing dangerous or suspicious in it that I could see.
Find the pieces with the red dots, Otmar told us.
He held one up to show us the little red dot painted on it. Fritz came back from whatever errand he'd been sent on, gave Otmar a cryptic nod, and then the four of us sifted through the equipment until we found all the ones with red dots and separated them out. Otmar swept all the other equipment off the bed with a theatrical clatter. With practiced skill, he quickly assembled the pieces with the red dots into one hole that fit exactly into one of the four scientific suitcases.
A bomb, Fritz said.
It was a bomb. It was obvious now. Wires, battery, a timer, and what looked like enough explosives to blow the top off the mountain. Otmar smiled.
Gentlemen, I give you our science project.
Even if the Swiss soldiers had searched our suitcases, they would never have found the bomb. It had been split up into pieces and hidden among the random useless equipment in our four suitcases.
This is why they needed four of us, and why nothing else mattered but our fervent devotion to the Führer.
We were nothing but four loyal mules, our suitcases packed with death. Nazi Germany's chief export. Otmar snapped the latches closed on the suitcase bomb and replaced it on the bed with one of the other empty scientific suitcases.
Quickly now, he told us. The civilian clothes from your suitcases, your papers, your money, only what you'll need for the trip home. Pack them together in here.
This was part of the plan we had at least all been briefed on, our escape. Once the deed was done, we were to descend the mountain and make our way by train to the border, posing as four Swiss boys on holiday. We had fake passports and everything. The border guards would be waiting to let us back into Germany, where we would be received with a hero's welcome. On the train from Berlin, Otmar and Erhard had talked endlessly about what medals we would receive. The medals would be more impressive, they reasoned, if we lost an arm or a leg on our mission. I would have to see what I could do to help them achieve that goal, at least. When the other suitcase was packed, Otmar snapped it closed and set it next to the one with the bomb.
Erhard and I will plant the bomb. The detonator is preset to 15 minutes, Otmar told us. Quex, you and Michael will go to the front desk and tell them you see a crack in the snowpack above the resort. The resort administrators will then sound the avalanche alarm, at which point the guests will be herded into the safety of the hotel's basement, deep inside the mountain. That is where the bomb will be set. 15 minutes later, the bomb will detonate and everyone inside will be killed.
Everybody? I said.
I thought we were just here to kill Professor Goldschmidt.
Otmar shrugged.
What do a few more dead scientists matter? None of them are German.
Otmar checked his watch, then handed Fritz a suitcase.
You will carry the suitcase for our escape. You must hurry when you go to the front desk. Once the bomb is activated, it cannot be turned off. You must sound the alarm at precisely the same moment we turn on the timer. That will give the hotel staff just enough time to get everyone to the basement before the bomb goes off. We will meet you at the cable car and ride back down together. Synchronize watches.
Wait, we're doing this now? I said. I panicked. I had thought I'd at least have a chance to approach a guard during the conference, let them know what the plan was.
Otmar picked up the suitcase with the bomb in it.
Goldsmith is already here. Quex saw him in the lobby.
So that's